Captain,
asteroid on a collision course.
Shields up, red alert.
Starboard impact!
Discovery, I am in total free fall.
Detonation confirmed.
Get down!
I'm not leaving them to die.
Transfer complete.
And welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, flying good.
Well, we're here this week, folks, for the return of Star Trek Discovery, the premiere of Season 2.
Yeah, Cam.
Brother.
I have to ask you, we just did an episode last week about crafting the perfect season premiere, and
yes,
we had a lot of parameters about what this means for maybe creating kind of a mission statement for the remainder of the season. Look, we can dive into kind of the finer minutiae of it all, but just from your perspective, does this get you excited? Does Brother get you excited about what the season has in store? Do you think it actually serves as kind of like a good mission statement for what we might be able to expect moving forward?
I think in some ways, yes. I think it does fit the criteria that I laid out that I look for, and that it reestablished the tone. It told us why these characters matter to us. It reminded me of my affection for them and why I want to continue with them. It set up, you know, the various plot threads we're going to follow. And it then introduced the new elements, I thought, very well with, like, the introduction of Pike and Tignataro's new character, you know, who's very quirky. Like, I thought it did a good job laying these sort of groundwork. Maybe where this one stumbled, at least a little for me, and I'm looking forward to a rewatch because, you know, Star Trek Discovery is like a bullet, and this thing is like a bullet.
Yes.
And I'm okay. When we did the premiere of Star Trek Discovery Season 1, I didn't know where that show was going to go, but I could wrap my head around what a Klingon war is in the sense of like, okay, I get this. Whereas the premiere, you know, this episode Brother, I'm still unclear as to where I'm going.
What the Red Angels mean.
Yes.
And
yes.
It seems as if this is going to be the overarching story for Season 2.
Correct, yeah.
And so maybe the question we can dive into a little bit deeper is this an interesting mystery to follow?
My answer at this very moment is no.
Sure.
But, I mean, you know...
Maybe... But you know what, for me, there are other elements that they've introduced here that I'm very interested in exploring as the season goes on.
Same. Yeah. I agree. It's just, so far, the overarching... Essentially what they've been hyping. Because, you know, there's little bits throughout this episode that they're introducing for stories that are going to go throughout the season, hopefully. But they didn't market any of that. What they marketed was Red Angels to us.
And
we were
Lenny Kravitz.
And Lenny Kravitz. And what we were doing mostly was scratching our heads. And so I expected maybe more of a layout as to what exactly a Red Angel is or why it matters or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I didn't really get that. And so I just spent most of it going, don't know what any of this means, but... You know, I don't know if you'd shown me, say, the first episode, the Vulcan Hello, last season, asked me, so what do you think? I would have had a good idea. It was more that second episode that kind of really confirmed the trajectory. So maybe episode two of the second season of Discovery is really going to nail down where this season is going. So it's tough to really gauge in that regard.
Are you going to be choked if we don't get to see, and I don't think there's just going to be any reason why, but if we don't get to see the bridge of the 1701?
They never go there.
They never go there.
No, they keep have to walk. They have to keep going up to the door and be like, "Hold on, we got an emergency. We got to go.
Let's go visit Botany." You know, there doesn't seem to be any logical reason to visit the bridge next week, but
yeah.
I just really want to go visit like the new version of the 1701 bridge.
They are going to go there for sure.
They will.
Rebecca Romijn is going to be on the bridge.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So for me, I think the biggest thing when I think about what the mission statement seems to be right now, it's one of the last lines in the episode. It's when Captain Pike turns to Burnham,
right,
and he says, you know, wherever our mission takes us, we'll try to have some fun, make some noise, ruffle some feathers. Do you think this was a direct sort of address to the audience, Cam.
It felt like it.
Yeah.
Okay, do you remember that episode in season two of Next Generation, The Royale?
Cam, it is my screensaver. It's just watching them going through the revolving door again and again and ending out
on the
same side.
No, that's the episode, Tyler.
Okay.
But there's that moment at the end of the episode where Picard is asking Riker, like, you know, what was that all about? And they're like, who knows? Could we ever know? And that felt very much like addressing, like, yeah, we don't know what the script is about.
Yeah.
That whole line from Pike felt very much like, folks, we heard you.
Yeah, yeah.
Boy, did we hear you.
Well, I think it also shows some self-awareness on the part of the writers, where I think, and this is what we've been discussing this a lot, though, it's like Discovery works best when it's not all dark and gloomy, and it's really the lighter moments. And I have to be honest, like, maybe the story elements didn't jump out to me so much in this episode.
Yeah.
What did, though? All the character moments.
Yeah, big
and
time.
And especially, like, kind of the lighter stuff. And I think the show, it's running on all cylinders, where you really can connect with the characters. And there's so many great examples that we can dive into.
Yeah.
Before we kind of start kind of delving in and picking the episode apart piece by piece, which is always fun when you have Star Trek fans critiquing every little bit.
Of course.
But something jumps out to me, Cam. This was an episode directed by the showrunner,
Alex Kurtzman.
Who wasn't the showrunner at the time. There's a lot of upheaval behind the scenes until he took over the reins.
That kicks in where? Do you think mid-season?
I'd say about maybe one-third to halfway through
this
season. Yeah. And he directed this one. And I kept thinking, is this the most JJ episode of Discovery that we have ever seen?
Yes.
Just
for
in terms of directing, for
definitely.
Sure. Yeah.
Yes.
And
there are moments that just feel completely ripped out of, like, Star Trek Into Darkness, including the wetsuits.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of which, do you love how they're all color coded?
Yeah.
I just found that delightful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wonder, you know, there's a lot of accusations that, you know, Discovery is just kind of a ripoff of the Kelvinverse. I kind of roll my eyes at that sort of criticism.
I don't think it is at all when you talk about character dynamics.
No, no.
And the way its stories unfold. But in some of the visual elements and the action elements, very much so.
And I would just say just the directing style. I think like Kurtzman.
And the editing.
Yeah, but look, Kurtzman, he's a student of JJ, so it totally makes sense, but I've just never seen it so explicit before in Star Trek Discovery, and this was all over it, especially with, let's be honest, that the big kind of action sequence throughout, which was that landing pod sequence that's very exciting. How do you think that compares to the EV suit sequence that we got in episode one of season one?
I'm not that crazy about the landing pod sequence.
Yeah.
I thought it was just kind of overload. And it's asking me a lot where it's like, yeah, these people are just barreling through these meteors at like high speeds, but they're not hitting anything.
Yeah.
It's just
No. Do you want to walk back on that for just a second?
Oh, in what regard?
The mansplainer?
Oh, yeah, well.
He meets his...
He gets it, of course.
He meets his maker.
In a moment that you could see coming from a mile away.
I know.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, okay, the one
was
thing
it Connolly, though, I think?
Connolly, yeah. The science officer, Evan Connolly.
Yeah.
I have to be honest, I'm just... I love that there was some misdirect there, because we do have a red shirt going on this mission, and I was like, oh.
The one who's like, is this possible? I don't even know what's going on.
I was oh, she's a goner.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they're like, no, let's get rid of the toxic masculine mansplainer, which I've already seen criticisms on social media be about, like, oh, of course they would get rid of the man who knows stuff. I'm like
this character is written so unlikable.
Oh, of course.
I'm like, how is this character even existing? Because Pike seems like an incredibly reasonable, rational guy.
Yeah,
it seems a little like a character that he would not be like, hello,
do you know? I think he's Dr. Boyce's nephew. And he's just kind of stuck with them. Like, were you disappointed we didn't get a Dr. Boyce sighting?
I feel like they're going to, you know, hold out for sweeps.
Okay. Yeah.
Sweeps don't even matter in the world of online streaming, but they're still waiting for sweeps.
Well, you know, okay, let's get into it. Let's get into nitty-gritty here. I think the biggest thing that I think both you and I want to talk about is the introduction of Anson Mount as Pike.
Yeah.
And we've seen so many different versions of Pike, and... Where is he for you right now at this point? I personally, I'm digging him.
I think he's really, really, really good.
Yeah.
I was really pleased to see that right off the bat, they'd found an angle on how to write him so he sounds like a character who does not talk like anyone else on the show.
Can you give me an example of that?
Well, it's just like the way he phrases things, his energy, the way he just delivers his dialogue. he feels like almost like a visitor from another show, but in a really solid way, where it's like he's magnetic. He's a presence that immediately jumps out as like, this is a captain. He's someone who's, when he's on the ship, all eyes are on him because he has that magnetism, that charisma.
The moment that jumps out to me the most, and I think this is a very important one, is when they get towards the end of the mission.
Yeah.
And he turns to Saru and he's like, I think the rest of the mission is yours. And he hands him back the captain's seat. This is a, like, okay, let's be honest. We're in a very tumultuous time in society right now. And I think what they want.
We are.
But look, if you think about the Me Too movement, if you think about diversity and inclusiveness, and look, I think Discovery, there's a big contingent of Star Trek fans that are accusing Discovery of being some PC campaign against, you know, Star Trek ideals, which I'm just like, whatever, guys.
We heard from some of them.
Yeah, but look, if you put yet another white male in charge of the bridge, I think what they want to do is, like, let's make sure that this guy is kind of the anti-toxic masculine authority figure. He's an ally here.
Yeah.
And I just love that moment where he gives it back to Saru, and he's just like, he kind of, and then we get to the very end where he's in his captain's uniform and he says, let's call it a bit of a joint custody situation,
right? Yeah.
Which makes me very curious about what the relationship is going to be with Pike and the rest of the crew moving forward in the season. I like how they're planting these seeds, and I'm loving Anson Mount. Like, I really wasn't familiar with him before this.
Well, you'd watch Britney Spears' Crossroads a lot of times, though.
How would you define a lot? More than 14? Okay, whatever, man. Sue me.
In a month.
Don't judge me. But, you know, so I wasn't certain how he's going to compare to, say, a Jeffrey Hunter, a Bruce Greenwood, who I think was just an amazing version of Pike that we got in the Kelvinverse.
I mean, Jeffrey Hunter is the, you know, the original. He's the originator of the role, and yet I don't really, and I've said this on the podcast before, I don't feel like I have a grasp on who that character is at all in terms of his personality.
He seems very aloof in what we've seen of him before, and when he was at his most engaged, he was, Sean Kenny was playing him in a wheelchair.
Beep.
Yeah, exactly. So I think Anson Mount actually had like a lot of leeway.
And he has like fun dialogue where he has that, like, the where's my red thing?
I was just going to say,
where's my
that
damn red thing or whatever? Yeah.
But there's other moments where he's just like, here, bridge crew, can I get a roll call? I want to know who I'm working with. And I also love the moment where he's like, I don't want to hear ranks. And then Arium says, Lieutenant Commander Arium. And I think we are starting to get hints about who this Arium character, who I think just gripped a lot of fans just by how cool looking she was.
Right,
and like that cool voice. We got probably a total screen time of maybe 4 minutes last season, like, if that, just including background shots.
Yeah.
So I'm digging what they're doing with Arium, who's getting a lot more screen time.
Yeah.
Mind you, a new actress is playing Arium, Cameron.
Yes.
Yeah.
For reasons that we are still not clear on, really.
And the reason I think we're even more confused, though, is because Sarah Mitich, the original Arium, she was in Las Vegas back in August at the convention, the big Star Trek Las Vegas convention. And she was out there saying, like, embracing the Arium love that she was getting and everything like that. And then we come back, and it is now Hannah Cheeseman that is playing Arium.
Yeah.
But Sarah Mitich is not off the series. She is now playing Lieutenant Nilsen, sans makeup. And the only reason I was aware of this is because there's a shot where you can see both Lieutenant Nilsen as well as Lieutenant Commander Arium, like, standing next to each other in the shuttle bay.
Yeah.
And I remember watching this, and I did a double take, because the thing is, like, the only reason I knew that it was Sarah Mitich is because I saw her at the convention, and then I was just really confused, and was like, no, that must be a different actress. Why would they do a split screen shot of, you know, Sarah Mitich with makeup and Sarah Mitich without makeup? And I was very confused until we got to the end credits, and I saw that it was actually, in fact, you know, one Hannah Cheeseman that's now playing Arium, which, I don't know, more power to the actress if she doesn't have to do 3 hours of makeup anymore. So you got that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess theories are maybe she developed an allergy or something. We don't know. Like, that's a thing. That's, our friend's been kicking theories back and forth as to what could have caused this.
Well, but remember, like, we've heard stories from Michael Dorn and from Andy Robinson of just about how brutal the makeup is.
Yeah.
Doug Jones apparently has just the biggest immunity in all of Hollywood to this sort of stuff.
Well, Terry Farrell couldn't do Apocalypse Rising because the Klingon makeup wouldn't work for her.
Yeah.
And so, hopefully that's not the case. I don't know. We'll find out, I guess, in the coming weeks.
Yeah. Let's go back to Pike, though, because what they're also trying to do is establish him essentially as the anti-Lorca.
Yeah.
And so they do give a couple... Oh, yeah,
very on the nose.
He
even says, I'm not Lorca.
No, Cam, it's me grasping the subtext within the series. That's how I was able to capture that. Yeah. But I think it's important here that we do have at least some surface level Lorca acknowledgement after getting zero Lorca acknowledgements after his death.
Yeah.
But they're saying, look, he's a man who betrayed you. I'm not here to betray you. And
right.
I like how everything that they're doing with Pike is just kind of juxtaposed to the actions and the character of Lorca. Even the fact that we even get like a Cage shout out
when
he finds that leftover fortune from Lorca's empty fortune cookies. And so
it's like one day I'll have a fun adventure involving a Cage.
Well, you know, so I was doing the math in my head. So I've been all over like Facebook since I saw the premiere last night.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because people were asking about the time difference between the Cage and this episode.
Yeah.
We had
that conversation back and forth too, and we thought maybe 5 years. But what's the consensus?
3 years.
3 years.
So
okay.
The Cage took place 3 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and then I guess we have about 8 or 9 years until the Menagerie.
Right.
So it is going to be interesting. I don't think like Anson Mount is going to be a one and done, you know, for the season sort of character.
Especially not after seeing him in this episode.
No. We've talked about it on the podcast before. We suspect very much that after the season ends and Anson Mount is no longer contracted to do Discovery for the full season, they'll probably announce like a Captain Pike spinoff featuring the Enterprise crew.
I think you thought it should be called Star Trek Original Crew. Am I right?
That was your idea. I'm not like over the moon over my pitch for a title, but I think Star Trek Constitution could work. Star Trek 1701. I don't know what they would call it other than, I don't know, if the title wasn't already taken, I would say Star Trek The Final Frontier. Just something a little bit different.
They go to find God again. You're like, boy, you know, the title, it was kind of weird to reuse the title, but to reuse the same plot.
and Cyborg's showing up.
Yeah.
You know, it's a Cyborg
prequel.
Like a
dancing Catwoman? Yeah. Like, what is going on?
I would love if Lower Decks does just a total homage to The Final Frontier.
Ethan Peck shows up and does the Vulcan nerve pinch on a horse.
Okay, well, you know, maybe you're leading us to kind of a segue here. Let's talk a little bit about the Burnham and Spock stuff that they are setting up here. Because I'll be honest, like, I'm much
better. That works a lot better than the Red Angel teasing.
You're taking the words right out of my mouth. I am far more intrigued by the Spock Burnham mystery than I am by this Red Angel mystery.
Right.
And I'll fast forward just a little bit, but when we hear Ethan Peck doing Spock's voice at the end, I was like, dear Lord, he's captured Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah.
I was just sucked in and impressed beyond belief. How do you think he's going to be doing once we actually see him on screen, Kevin?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's always that difference between, you know, hearing the voice versus seeing them physically.
Yeah.
And so the voice, I'm sold. It's just like, will he carry enough of that physical essence of Nimoy? I don't know yet. From the brief snippets I've seen in like trailers, my reaction is it's going to take some getting used to. But I don't know. Once I actually see him in an episode, in actual scenes that are, you know, beginning to end, maybe I feel completely differently.
I think they do have an out, though. And then, A, it is a prequel. This is not necessarily the Spock that we're most familiar with.
No, that's true.
And who knows what this Red Angel experience has done to him. I'm still a little bit foggy on what exactly is going on here.
I don't know. It looks like an escapee from a Marilyn Manson video, from what I can tell. The Red Angel that we saw a glimpse.
Yeah. That was, well, Pike was, like, I didn't
Pike
quite,
is the angel.
I didn't quite understand, like, how Burnham was getting these visions of the Red Angel. You know, she was knocked out. Is there some sort of telepathic link that she shares with Spock, similar to what she shares with Sarek? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, speculation on my part here.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot of mystery behind what's going on between Burnham and Spock. And somebody had posited online that maybe there's, like, she offered to help him with Pon Farr.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, that's disgusting. But then when I watched the episode again for the second time, I was like, huh. There's, like, a lot of weirdness in, like, kind of the subtext if you read into it.
Okay.
Which, like,
I will look for that on my rewatch.
Yeah, it was kind of bizarre.
I had not stumbled across this fan theory, and I don't want to know where you read it.
No.
It's like DeviantArt.
No, it's TylerOrton.com. No. Believe me, when I first read that, I was like, whatever, guys. And then when I watched the episode, I was like, okay, I can kind of understand how it, like, you could pick up on some of those strands. But
sure.
To me, look, that'd be like kind of a horrible, horrible turn for the writers to go if they're talking about kind of this, it's essentially incest, right? You know.
Well, not really.
Foster brother, foster sister, they were raised together. It's weird, dude.
Oh, it's weird, but it happens.
Okay. I won't deny it's happened before.
Yeah.
I just think it would be very weird for us to explore that in Star Trek.
It's the final frontier, Tyler.
Yeah, okay. So what do you think could be a possibility here? Like I don't even know where to go unless it has something to do with maybe his entry into Starfleet versus that Vulcan expeditionary group that we know that Burnham was denied entry because, you know, Sark wanted to make sure that Spock could go instead.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, from everything that we understand, and maybe I'm going a bit to the Kelvinverse, you know, Spock wanted to go to Starfleet through his own volition, so I don't think it was necessarily, like, something to do with Burnham. I'm very curious about where this break in the relationship stems from, but we know from the moment Burnham steps into that house on Vulcan,
yeah,
she's not really welcomed by her younger foster brother.
Well, at this point, Sarek has given Burnham his, was it Katra? Was that the term?
Yeah, because he was kind of part of the rescue.
Yeah, to
initially.
Save her life.
Yeah.
I feel like that might be part of it.
He's picking. Well, I definitely think the Amanda stuff is going to be paying off big. By the way, Cam, we still have no idea how old Amanda is supposed to be.
Well,
the actress does not age at all. She seems to be the actress is Sneakle Martin Green, and I'm blanking on the Canadian actress who's playing her. She's been in like pretty much like every other TV show.
Mia Kirshner.
Yes, the actresses are 12 years apart.
Right.
So maybe SMG is playing young. And
I think she is.
Mia Kirshner is playing old.
Yeah.
But still, the fact that Mia Kirshner appears to be the same age in the flashbacks, too.
Right.
I know. Anyways.
I can go with it.
Yeah. So
I think the future. Everyone's skin is just flawless.
It's the best skin cream in the world.
I mean, you see characters like Argyle, and you see how people age in those in that era.
Well, the fascinating thing, Argyle is like 94 years old. So,
yeah, it was his retirement.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm leaning more towards like a break in the relationship over the Amanda stuff,
right? Because
we get a lot more of those. Like, well, they're not even allusions to Alice in Wonderland. It's very much
no. It's like the I'm not Lorca. It's pretty on the nose.
Yeah. I did love her blowing out the candles and all the holograms.
That was
disappearing.
Great. Yeah.
That was
I like that
fun.
Little touch. Yeah. Sometimes the technology on Discovery can get a little over the top, where you're like, boy, this is well outside of established canon for Star Trek. Like, I am someone who will totally go along with holograms. That's totally fine. But there are moments where you're like, wow, we are off in the, in the whole other world of Star Trek here.
I'm just thinking if they had comparable budgets for, say, the 90s versions of Star Trek, I wonder what they would have been able to do.
Yeah.
Because you can see that they were a little bit stymied by, like, they're producing Star Trek on a shoestring, and it still looked fantastic, though.
Yeah.
And we've been watching a lot of these two-parters, and they hold up so well. So I'll just go on a little bit of tangent here.
Yeah.
You and I complained a lot about the VFX in Season 1.
Yeah.
And we thought they looked a little bit too, I guess, stylized?
Until we watched the Blu-ray.
Then we watched the Blu-ray, and we were actually quite impressed. We're watching it back on cable television. It does air on television here in Canada.
For this season.
It does look as if their license will be up after Season 2, and they're going to make all Canadians watch it through CBS All Access going forward. I'm not looking forward to that, because from everything I hear, maybe not the best app to use.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, but I am curious, though, what did you think of the VFX in this one versus what we saw in Season 2? Season 1,
I actually have a note where I just said, how much did this cost? It looked very expensive.
Like, it looked like
the money was all over the screen.
Like, leaps and bounds above what we were seeing in Season 1. And I was just, there were just shots of them. You would see the crew walking in the corridors,
yeah,
and you could see there's an exterior shot of the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this just looks gorgeous. And just the renderings look so much more realistic than what we saw in season one. So I was just blown away by the VFX quality versus what we had in season one.
I'm fascinated by this new era of television where shows get less viewers, but somehow they put more money into them.
You know what? It's all a new game. I think they're just thinking like leaps and bounds ahead in terms of years and years. They know this is going to be amortized over a long period of time, so they might as well put all their money, front load it, get viewers sucked in, and keep going from there. I guess CBS thinks it's going to be worth it. I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
My only concern is I think if you didn't have budget, you'd have to use your imagination more with older Star Trek. And I think that was actually to Star Trek's benefit back in the day.
Yeah.
There were constraints. There's episodes, Troi-centric episodes, where we see her like floating through like foggy black backgrounds and stuff where it didn't look so pretty.
Or tons of just amazing imagination on no money in the original series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so if I can get Star Trek looking like a great cinematic feast for the eyes, I will take it while I can, though.
Yeah.
So, let's go back to the Michael Burnham and Spock stuff. I don't know. Any theories on your part about what the big, you know, break in the relationship could be?
I have a note here, and it was, Sarek seems a lot nicer to Burnham than he did Spock.
Mm-hmm.
Always. And so, like, how much is just the sense of, like, this outsider coming into the family and essentially taking the parents' attention away from Spock?
Well, it's kind of like when I'm at your parents' place.
Oh, exactly.
And they just, like, revere me. I don't even think they let you eat at the same table as us.
I'm out back with the dog.
Yeah. Fighting over the scraps.
Eating out of the food bowl. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, we've seen that Spock's relationship was pretty chilly with his family. And Spock is half human. And so, as a young child, he would be bouncing back and forth between that Vulcan state of mind versus, you know, the emotions of a child, of a human child. And so when you have someone like Burnham who's coming in, who's got your father's Katra, and is in some ways almost like this, I don't even know what to call her in like the eyes of Sarek. She's like a miracle child in a way. And, you know, like how much does that mess with a kid like Spock, who seems to be quite... Spock seems to have some problems in his younger years, we've seen.
Yeah.
And, you know, they even showed this in the Kelvinverse. Like, it takes a while before Spock kind of settles into that sort of stable Spock we know and love from the original series and from, you know, Star Trek Beyond, for example. But I just wonder how much of that is tying into Burnham, because there's so much angst with Spock. You see it in the original series in episodes where he gets, you know, on some sort of, you know, alien hallucinogen or a Ponfar or something like that. There's so much angst in that character. And so I think there's a lot just built into canon for Spock to have a lot of angst about a sibling coming in.
And I think that Burnham benefits very much from the fact that, look, as a foster daughter, I think they're going to give her a little bit more leeway as well.
Her parents have been killed.
Yeah.
So she needs that sort of, you know, support system.
Yeah. So I think gripped far more by, say, some of the character stuff that's going on.
I was going to say, too, and, you know, young Spock is dreaming of space eels. I mean, like, this kid obviously has some issues.
Yeah, I didn't quite know. Literally, like, if some four-year-old slammed the door on my face.
He reminded me of The Good Son. Do you remember that movie?
With Macaulay Culkin and Elijah Wood.
Yeah. She's Elijah Wood. He's Macaulay Culkin. Ooh, it really does work out, because I think, wasn't Elijah Wood, like, he'd had, like, a death in his family, and he went to join Macaulay Culkin's family? It's, like, 1993. I know that's
been a while.
For everyone listening to go back to that movie, but...
Yeah. Maybe look it up on Netflix if it's there.
Yeah, like, young Spock looked a little intimidating.
So, let's talk about the other character stuff that I think is important here. I want to jump in on Stamets.
Yeah.
Because I think we're a little bit disappointed with how he didn't really seem to be acknowledging Dr. Hugh Culber's death.
Right.
At least in the last two episodes.
Yeah, I know you got 10-second bit of dialogue with Ash Tyler?
Yeah.
And you're like, okay.
And then the next episode, he's smiling at spores sprouting from the ground. And
standing there collecting a badge for him in the finale.
I could totally buy that this is a guy who totally compartmentalizes things and just wants to, you know, shove it, you know, beneath the surface.
Right.
I do like the fact that they're very upfront in the first episode mm-hmm. with him saying outright, like, this place is haunted for me.
Right.
I see him everywhere I am. I need to move on. And I totally understand that. And I think it makes a lot of sense.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. No one ever felt that way about Tasha Yar.
I know. Well, I guess
they did deal with that to a certain degree,
but it took a while. So, you know, they're dealing with the Culber stuff at a much swifter rate than they are with the Tasha Yar
and
stuff.
Just with more, I think, psychological realism than the other Star Trek series really would have.
Yeah.
And so I did like that, like that he's kind of disappearing into his own little world where he's got that. What is that? That thing that he has on his side of his head where he's watching videos of...
It's the future of smartphones.
I guess so,
Me and one of my coworkers were talking about how there will be brain chips within our lifetime, and neither one of us really wants to sign up for it.
I'd be okay with it as soon as they get, you know, the beta tests all done.
Okay, fair enough.
I'm not going to be an early adopter.
No.
But you can see that he's living in his own little world here, and... Yeah, it does make sense to me that, like, Stamets is obviously a character who's quite obsessive. We saw that throughout the first season, and that he was someone who was very fixated on certain things. And so once you remove the spore drive, like, he's achieved his life's goal or whatever. And so what does he have left other than this right now?
Okay, and that's a very good point, because there's a line in that kind of made me raise my eyebrows, where he's talking about how Cassilian prima donna will practice and practice for this one performance, and then she'll take a dagger to her heart, and that will be it. Should we be reading too much into what that means for his own mindset right now? Because he followed up by saying that he's lived a lifetime here on Discovery with everything that he's done and accomplished in terms of science.
I don't think they're going to get rid of Stamets. That's what you're asking.
Look, I don't think that they're going to kill him off. And honestly, I really don't buy the fact that he's going to go to Vulcan Science Academy after the Red Angel mission.
There's no way he's
ends.
Not going, or he's not going there.
Yeah, but I do wonder if they are going to go to dark places where he's at right now with the death of his husband.
Well, we always see that, you know, certain characters in Star Trek will go on these very dark journeys.
Yeah.
This might be his season to have that story, because I don't know who else it would be. I think Burnham went there in the season one.
Yeah.
And so you're not going to do that to her in season two, I don't think, again. You'll have, I think, some, you know, intense stuff going on with the Spock relationship, but I don't think they're going to take her to the dark places that they did in season one. Maybe this is Stamets' season to have that sort of journey of discovery.
So what do you think of Stamets' character journey since we met him? Because I feel that he's
been spotty.
He's been a very different character than the one that we were originally introduced. Remember when we first introduced to him, I said on the podcast, Cam, this is a character I've been waiting for. This is Tyler Orton.
And the writers
screen.
Were like, we got to change this fast.
Audiences will hate this kind of person. Yeah.
No person turns on their TV wanting to see this.
But you asked me another question towards the end of, end of December. Yeah, on the podcast, you're like, who's your favorite character on Star Trek Discovery? If you asked me, you know, in early season one, I would have said Stamets.
Yeah.
Right now, it's Saru. Like, that's kind of the character that I'm digging most. And I think his journey, for like 4 or 5 episodes, I was like, I like how he's kind of this cold SOB, and then he starts getting groovy on mushrooms, and then he's really not acknowledging the death of his partner.
Yeah.
And now I just kind of wonder what he is right now. Like, it's hard to pin him down.
Well, they didn't do a lot with him in the latter half of Discovery.
No.
The first season.
Well, he's in a coma.
Yeah.
And then we had that weird mycelial episode where he... Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think they're going to have to kind of redefine who this character is going to be for the series going forward, or at least this season.
Yeah.
Because I talked about, I think it was a video, YouTube video we did, where we were talking about predictions for the next season of Discovery. And I said, my prediction was, we're going to see a new role for Stamets on the show, because the Spore stuff is kind of done for now. And so what do you do with this character? And I think right now we're in the midst of kind of a transition period of, like, what is Stamets and right at this point in his life, and who is he to Star Trek Discovery, the show?
All I want, though, is for him to, you know, go to Vulcan, meet up with his uncle, the one who is in a Beatles cover band.
Yeah.
I just want him to be singing Maxwell Silver Hammer and, you know.
But, I mean, what's his job on the ship right now?
That's what I'm, they've kind of put away the spore drive.
Yes.
Which I also wonder what Arium's job is on the ship because she was a spore drive operator on the bridge.
Yeah.
So I guess you could just... Yeah, we can, and Burnham is the science officer.
Right.
She is a full commander. He's a lieutenant commander. I don't know what his job is.
I know there was like back and forth of like people thinking he was the chief engineer in season one, but then it was never said outright.
Well, so there was actually something on screen there, like when they had pulled his profile up on screen and said chief engineer, but then the writer said, no, he's not chief engineer.
Yeah.
Which I buy, because like he's always had the science badge on.
Well, and just everything we've seen with chief engineers on the show, he doesn't fit the bill for what any of those guys do in their day-to-day jobs.
No.
And it's a little confusing. And I mean, I can 100% believe he is the chief engineer when they're operating off a spore drive.
Okay.
That makes sense to me. But when you remove that, that's where I go, okay.
So I don't think we ever met the chief engineer of Discovery in season one.
Right.
Now we have this interesting setup with Juan Tignataro as Commander Jet Reno.
I thought you said Janet Reno.
I kept thinking.
I was like, pardon me?
I kept thinking like the Will Ferrell SNL version, which no way in like this day and age could you ever get away with that on TV because it's kind of homophobic and all that. But I like whenever I hear Janet Reno, I just think of Will Ferrell playing Janet Reno now.
Right.
Although there was that episode of SNL where Janet Reno actually appeared with Will Ferrell.
That's right, yeah.
So
she had a sense of humor about it.
She did. Yeah. But Jet Reno, which makes me think of Joan Jett, who we went to a Joan Jett concert years ago, which that was pretty badass.
It was.
She's a legend, so maybe that's a shout out. What do you think of this
Shout out to Joan Jett. Yeah. That's something people didn't expect when they tuned in this week's podcast.
Anyway, she's a cherry bomb.
Yeah, of course.
What do you think of Commander Reno? What I'm getting is, do you think there's a possibility for her to turn up in a recurring role as the new chief engineer aboard Discovery? Because it's a very weird sort of prominent role to give to this random engineer aboard a medical frigate, and then just the person just disappears.
Well, especially a character who, if you look at this episode alone, is inconsequential.
Yes.
Everything she's talking about in terms of her crew and all this sort of stuff is like, it's nothing. It's just, it means nothing. Like, it doesn't contribute to the plot of this episode in what's, you know, in any way, shape, or form. She's there to just kind of be rescued in this mission, but obviously she's going to be on the show going forward, and so it makes a lot of sense to slot her into a position on Discovery.
Yeah.
I'm just very curious what that will be. It reminded me a little bit, actually.
Well, if you're curious about what it would be, I think it would have to be Chief Engineer.
Chief Engineer. I mean, that makes the most sense.
Yeah.
But although maybe she's a doctor at this point, the chief medical officer.
Well, there you go.
Considering the miracles she was working.
Although I do love Dr. Pollard giving Burnham some shade Burnham was talking about how she's the worst patient in the world. And Pollard's like, yep.
Why isn't Pollard a character?
I don't know. Well, you know, it's because Culber was the assistant chief medical officer that we would follow, blah, blah, blah. Anyway.
Yeah. But this actually reminded me a lot of Scotty in Star Trek 2009.
Okay.
Where he's just on this, like, you know, desolate
outpost,
you know, outpost slash asteroid in this case, and they just happen upon them and then bring them back onto the ship. And I feel like they're going to be a member of the crew in no time.
So instead of a Keenster, she now has Valentine, the pumping heart.
or a comatose Tellarite.
Yeah, with her brain fluid all over her fingers.
Yeah.
That was interesting. But I'll say this. I think back, and I think it's... I'm being a bad fan if I constantly want to compare this series to Star Trek The Next Generation, which I think a lot of fans want to do.
Yeah.
But I can totally imagine an episode of TNG where it centers around having to rescue this engineer and these patients from this crash-landed ship on an asteroid. Yeah. And I was actually in love with this idea of like this engineer learning how to be a doctor, keeping people alive, figuring out all these sorts of things. But the thing is with Discovery is like you don't have moments more than, you know, you don't have more than like 5 minutes to kind of spend with this sort of cool situation, this cool concept that I think they would have turned that entire episode on, say, TNG.
That's a frustration I just have with Discovery. Not every episode because they don't always do it.
Yeah.
But we saw it in, for example, Context is for Kings, which is an episode all about setting up the ship Discovery and Lorca and how the crew works. And then they, you know, shoehorn in that little bit about, you know, Ripper on the ship. And it's like this, like, breathless 5 minutes, and you're like, okay, we're back on Discovery.
Yeah.
Back to the character stuff. And, you know, this was an extended premiere in that it was longer than usual.
Yeah.
And so they spent, I think, more time on this whole medical frigate rescue than they would have normally on, say, episode 5 of season 2 of Discovery. But it still does feel like this kind of, like, breathless, like, here's a mission. Okay, back to the kind of the character dynamics and the show at large. And so, yeah, Tig Notaro, I mean, I think she's fine on the show. Like, I think this character could have personality. I didn't get enough yet to really get a grasp on, like, what this character could be on the show or how they could contribute just in terms of gelling with the other cast members. But
I think she might be taking over that kind of prickly engineer position that maybe Stamets previously had as a prickly science officer.
Maybe something like almost like a Pulaski personality that actually maybe works better and is a little more organic to the show as opposed to kind of being brought in awkwardly the way that Pulaski was with TNG. Yeah. That would be interesting, I think, on the show. And I think that type of personality is fun. We saw it, of course, with Bones in the original series as well. But yeah, like this whole section with her just feels so breathless. And when you look at it, her contributions to this side mission are pretty overwhelmed by heavy, 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 extensive pyrotechnics and CG action. And so it's kind of like, okay, oh, nice to meet you. Never see you again for the rest of this episode.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, look, we know they're going to blow all the money on the season premiere. So I'm looking forward to the cheap episode 3 where characters just sit in a room.
So, well, think about it. Way of the Warrior opened season 4 of DS9.
Yeah.
The episode that followed it was The Visitor.
Right.
So maybe The Visitor is coming up next, Cam.
We're going to see Tilly in old age makeup in a cabin.
You know, I don't think you've watched the latest season of True Detective yet.
No.
Okay, so Marshala Ali, he is playing three different versions of himself, three different timelines.
Right.
I'm always very wary of old age makeup.
Yeah.
I have never seen old age makeup so good than I have on True Detective season 3. Like, I'm just astounded by this. I really do wonder what they can do on Star Trek nowadays when, look, we've had old age makeup for like almost, I think pretty much every single Star Trek series. They'll get to it eventually with Star Trek Discovery.
Oh, I mean, how do you not?
Yeah.
It just seems like insanely fun to do.
Yeah.
Do you think they would do makeup or do you think they'd do CG?
Maybe a little bit of both.
Yeah. Because you see like Hayley Atwell, they aged CG for Captain America 2, or maybe it was 3. It might have been Civil War. I don't remember.
I think it was 2.
Was it 2?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, at the beginning of that. And it looked incredible.
Yeah.
And it was all CG. So I don't know. I mean, if Discovery's got some money to burn, they might do an episode where they do that sort of thing.
What's weird, like I'll just be out and about in the city, and people will come up to me and be like, do you have, like, CG makeup on? Like, or like, how do you look so good? You know, just as...
I thought they were going to say you look like you're from the Deadly Years.
Thanks, Cam.
Yeah.
Mind you, I would love to get Shatner to sign an autograph of that, like, still.
Yeah.
Like, nowadays, like, he does not look at
all.
He
looks great.
Like, yeah. Shatner looks, like, way better condition now.
I think that everyone does. I don't think there's anyone who looks as bad as that 60s era of when they made people look old.
Do you think that DeForest Kelly looked the worst, though?
What, in the Deadly Years?
Yeah. Or am I just conflating that with what I think, I'm picturing him in Encounter at Farpoint?
I think you're thinking Encounter at Farpoint.
Okay.
Yeah, he looked probably the worst.
Okay.
He didn't look like a human character.
No.
No. He looked kind of like Biff in Back to the Future 2, but like mutated in some way.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, like it's when instead of silicon, they had like wax.
Right.
Like put on
silly putty.
You know, it's like that Ricky Martin music video where they're like pouring wax on his chest.
Oh my God.
Leaving La Vida Loca.
We're doing shout outs to Joan Jett. We're doing callbacks to Ricky Martin videos.
I'm stuck in the past, Cam. That's why I'm talking about TNG.
I'm shouting out to the good son.
Yeah. Another character I want to touch on, though. Where do you think Tilly's at right now? Is she a different character? Have we been witnessing a journey with Tilly versus where we met her in season 1?
Oh, I think definitely. Mm-hmm. We're definitely seeing the evolution of this character and
how she's drunk on power in her own words.
Yeah, but how she's so much more confident.
Oh, yeah.
I love that. You know, there's a great moment in this episode where she's talking to Stamets. And I actually talked about this a handful of episodes ago, we did underexplored relationships in Star Trek. And I said I wanted to see more Tilly and Stamets because I thought they were interesting together. Yeah. And I thought this had a great moment where Stamets is like, you have this love for everyone around you. It's going to make you a great captain one day. But, you know, right now, can you just be quiet or whatever? But, like, you know, they get the funny line in there.
No,
but
like, I want you to say fewer words.
Yeah. But, I mean, I like that they've defined this character as someone who kind of has love for everybody and has, you know, that just that sense of, like, wearing her emotions on her sleeves at all times. It's something Star Trek does not write those characters traditionally. Mm-hmm. They write characters who are, you know, I think a little bit aloof, a little bit buttoned up, we saw in the past. I don't know, like, who would you say is the most, like, not in Discovery, in the other Star Trek series, like, the most emotionally open character? Maybe a Troi, but even...
I would say Jadzia Dax.
Yeah, that's a good call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then after that, honestly...
I would say, like, a Troi fits the bill in terms of, you know, in terms of when you're creating that character on paper. But the way the show directs all the characters on TNG, I don't know that it really applies that much to her.
Yeah.
It does, in theory.
And what kind of bugs me is like every single character that we're pointing to are women, which means that Star Trek is still kind of guilty of falling into some of those kind of stereotypical like character patterns. You know, it's just like, why can't we have like an emotionally available male, Cam?
What about a character like Culber, though? He definitely had
actually,
some of that,
you know,
too.
You know what? You're 100% correct.
Yeah.
And let's talk a little bit about Culber, who Wilson Cruz is now in the main credits, which is interesting for a dead man.
Yes. He's going to be in a lot of footage that Stamets is watching this season.
Is he? Look, you and I are kind of concerned about what the future holds for Culber in that... okay, so you kill off a character, and it received a lot of backlash because, you know...
I think deservedly.
Well, it was kind of a dumb death, but then there's this big kind of trope within Hollywood productions where you kind of, you have these, I don't want to call them token gay characters, but you have gay characters that are kind of there as kind of like a partner that is killed off.
Kind of the sacrificial lamb.
Sacrificial lamb for the plot, and also to give the other, you know, gay character who would be partners with them some sort of angst.
And a lot of the time, traditionally, not relating to this Star Trek Discovery, but in the past, a lot of that would have to do was they didn't necessarily want to show, like, gay romance on screen because of, you know, whether it was censors or whether it was just they didn't think that, you know, the movie would play in theaters or on TV or whatever. And so they would fall on that trope because it was like, yes, we have a gay character, but we don't have to showcase anything that would be perceived as, you know, quote unquote offensive to whoever out there is watching and, you know, advertisers are going to be nervous about. And so Discovery, I don't think, has that problem at all. And so I think it just made it that much more frustrating when that trope showed up because it didn't have that sort of 1990s TV ridiculous reasoning behind it. It felt more like almost like clumsy, like they didn't think it through.
Exactly. And but the problem was is then there's a lot of fan backlash from this, and everybody behind the scenes are like, oh, no, don't worry. Don't worry. Don't worry about this. And I'm just like, so does that mean that if a character dies on Star Trek, which, let's be honest, if a character dies in Star Trek, they're not really dead, blah, blah, blah.
Right, right.
But I think it takes away a lot of the tension if, like, the first major character death we have on the series, it's...
Well, other than Giorgio.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, but guess what?
Mirror
Giorgio is still around.
Little did you realize that you'd be seeing Giorgio in her own show one day.
But you know, like I could wrap my head around seeing like a Mirror Culber. But if his consciousness is somehow brought back through the mycelial network or something that I like, I'm having trouble then buying into the series having any sort of stakes.
Well,
to
it's kind of the comic book movie thing where characters don't actually die.
Yeah.
And I can totally go with it in comic books because no one in comic books dies.
Sure. Yeah.
It's like it's more about what it means to the characters in that moment versus what it means long term. And I can go with that. I will say this. I'm willing to give it a go because I think Culber was such a fantastic addition to the show.
So I think it was a total mistake.
Yeah.
Narratively.
Yes.
To kill him off initially. But I think
if
it's going to be...
find a way to do it that feels organic to the show.
I'm very concerned that they won't be able to do that, though. And it's going to feel like very wedged in. And as much as I like the character and I wish they never killed him off in the first place, I'm going to be kind of annoyed that they kind of arbitrarily bring him back to address one of their... like a mistake of their own doing.
Well, and it's even like, I can't even wrap my head around how you would even do that in terms of just like the physical form of Culber.
Yeah.
Like, I can, okay, I'm willing to go down the sci-fi path and say, like, they bring his consciousness back in some way or something.
Yeah.
But then what? You know, we saw in the original series they're trying to put consciousnesses into, like, really ugly robots. And I don't want to see, like, an ugly robot walk around.
Is that a Tomorrow is Yesterday?
Return to Tomorrow.
Return to Tomorrow. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
And, you know, we don't want to see, like, the awkward, really hideous android version of Culber walking around.
That would be amazing. Because, Cam, you've heard me say this. After we watched the Harry Mudd short trek, I was like, Cam, I've been dying for more androids.
Maybe
on
that's
Star
the
Trek.
Rainn Wilson returned appearance on Discovery. He's coming up with Culber's body. But, yeah, like, that's the thing. I can buy a consciousness coming back in some way. Sure, I'm willing to go down that road, but
supplied by a Harry Mudd body.
But yeah, it's the body part that I am like, well, okay, you know, this is where I go, this is like a science fiction show that's very difficult to get across in a way that is believable, that isn't fantasy. And so, I mean, I guess we can only wait and see what happens.
We'll wait and see. I think you and I are both skeptical.
Yeah.
But it is very notable that Wilson Cruz
is in the opening
in
credits.
In the opening credits.
Yeah.
What is also notable is that Shahzad Latif is not in the opening credits. And
right.
I think that lends itself only to the fact that he does not actually appear in the episode.
Right.
We had a fun YouTube video, got a lot of hits, where we were doing our top five predictions for Star Trek Discovery Season 2. I'd recommend all of our visitors go to YouTube.com and then just search Subspace Transmissions. So many great videos that you guys are missing out on if you're not watching them already.
Right.
And it's not just like a repeat of what we're doing on the podcast. So get some additional content there. I've done my job to promote the videos, Cam. But in our predictions, I was predicting that both Tyler and Laurel would be main characters. They'd be upped to the main cast in Season 2. And the fact that they don't appear in the main credits, I'm not reading into that at all because Wilson Cruz is bumped to the main credits.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't appear in, say, episode 2, I don't think he's going to be in the main credits.
Right,
and so the fact that Shahzad Latif and Mary Chifo do not appear in this episode, I think that as soon as they do, I think they're both going to be in the main credits as well.
Right.
Are you okay with the absence of one Laurel and one Ash Tyler in episode 1?
Yep.
I am
too.
Didn't
bother me at all.
Didn't bother me at all. And I think it was the smartest thing to do because I don't think you want to be flashing back to a storyline that is not tied to what we're going on in the season premiere.
Not only that, but it has no movement on it right now.
Exactly.
Like, so,
are you really intrigued on anything going on? Well, you know, okay, I'm phrasing that question in a bad way.
Right.
I'm genuinely curious about like what the future holds for Laurel.
Right.
I don't care so much about Tyler. I think there's potential there for them to have some interesting storylines, but I don't have enough. I don't know.
Oh, I have theories as to where Tyler's going.
Okay.
Not you.
Okay.
Ash
well,
Tyler.
That's what I was wondering. It's like,
yeah, I have real theories for that, but
I want them to take some time with our crew on the Discovery first before we dive into what's going on in Kronos, because like you and I, we love Laurel.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, I don't want Discovery to fall back, and they haven't so far. They've been good about it, but I don't want them to fall into this whole trap of like, well, we like all these characters, but we got to keep using them. We got to keep using them because, I mean, we watched a lot of Star Trek episodes in our time.
Only 700, you know.
And including the Royale like 50 times. But, you know, it's not
no,
like...
No, those are all 700 that I was talking about, Cam.
But it's not...
I don't even know why I'm hosting a podcast. The only episode of Star Trek I've seen is, you know, the Royale.
But it's not like, you know, they were like, okay, we've got to have Q in like 15 episodes a season. You know, it's like, yeah, bring them back for one episode.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want them to feel like, well, hey, we really love Mary Chifo as Laurel. We've got to give her like an 8-episode arc in the season of Star Trek Discovery. Like, do it if it feels necessary and it ties into what the overall story you want to tell for that season is great. I'm on board. But don't feel like you have to because the fans are going to be upset because Ash Tyler isn't on the season or Laurel isn't on the season. Like, don't bend over backwards to wedge things in just because.
I 100% agree with you.
And, you know, like, Pike is out of the gate really strong. Like, believe me,
How much can he bench?
Anson Mount, you don't want to know.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, like, I am 100% on board for Pike right now. But if you tell me, like, you know, in the future, he's going to, you know, go back to the Enterprise, as he will, and Discovery's going to go on, I don't want them to be, like, guys, we got to come up with ways to get Pike in 8-episode runs, or 6-episode runs in season 3 of Discovery, just because.
All right. So, speaking of which, one other prominent character that we did not see in episode 1 of season 2 was one Giorgio.
Yeah.
Are you curious at all at what Mir Giorgio is up to in the Prime
universe?
Not really. Nor am I. And
it's going to pay off soon, though.
Yeah, let's get it out of the way before we forget. But they've announced that a Section 31 spinoff is in development, and Michelle Yeoh, who we both love Michelle Yeoh.
Yes.
I don't think either one of us are huge, huge fans of Mir Giorgio. I think she had her moments, but...
Oh, she had some great moments.
For sure.
Yeah.
But having a series centered on her and Section 31.
Yeah.
I don't know if we are too giddy about that idea.
I think there's going to be more to this spinoff than what they're telling us now.
So I think you and I are kind of in agreement. The best way is if there's an idealistic Federation member who infiltrates Section 31.
Well, they've said it will have the optimistic spirit of Star Trek. They have confirmed that.
Sure.
So... Sure. Well, I mean, I guess. But I think there are going to be other characters on that show that they are not going to reveal right now. Mm-hmm. That is my genuine feeling. I think they are going to be segging that way throughout the second season of Discovery.
I want Dr. Boyce.
He's the star.
Yeah.
Michelle Yeoh is actually way down the bill. It's like Dr. Boyce. the mastermind of Section 31.
A young Kevin Riley.
Sure.
You know, there's got to be some randoms that they can... or Finnegan.
Because, you know, I just said I didn't want to see them bending over backwards to bring in characters who maybe aren't necessary to the journey of where Discovery is going. I think these characters could wind up on Section 31.
I just... do you think that Mir Giorgio needs to be brought back to Star Trek Discovery?
Star Trek Discovery...
marketing, she will be back.
Yes, I think she makes the most sense on Star Trek Discovery because of the ties with Burnham. I think, yes, that does work to do an episode a season or whatever they want to do. Yes, I think it works very well there. I think it's going to be very interesting to drop her in her own series and just see how that flies. Because... I'm just really curious what the viewership crossover is for people who are going to be watching Section 31. That's where I'm going to be very, very interested.
Okay, so, and I hesitate to say this, but, you know, Cam, I'll say it anyway. I fear that there's a big contingent of Star Trek fans that want to see Section 31, the series.
Although I've noticed a lot, it's funny, I noticed a lot more enthusiasm when it was a rumor than when I saw when it was confirmed. And suddenly people became a lot more like... I don't know that this is a great idea. Like, I'm concerned this is going to be dark and violent.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah.
The fact that Alex Kurtzman is responding saying, no, it will have the optimistic spirit of Star Trek, tells me that they are getting feedback that people are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see. I think that, you know, I think season 2 of Discovery is going to be a backdoor pilot for that show.
I think they're doing multiple backdoor pilots.
I think so too.
In season 2, which, hey, all the power. Like, Cam,
it's modern franchise building. It's the way it goes. It's about building the universe.
I was thinking about it as you and I were watching this, you know, season premiere.
Yeah.
And how years ago on the podcast, we're like, yeah, we're not getting any Star Trek on TV until 2020 at the earliest. Now we're being bombarded with what, like, the potential for like 8 or 9 spinoffs.
Yeah. We were like, hopefully we can review Axanar one day.
Hopefully, fingers crossed. So at this point, like, all the content that is on the horizon, I think really what CBS is doing is let's throw Jell-O to the wall and see what sticks. I can't really argue with that sort of business style. I don't think all of these spinoffs that we're hearing about are actually going to make it on air.
Right.
I think the ones that are guaranteed right now, the Picard spinoff,
Lower Decks. Yeah.
Beyond that, I don't think anything is a guaranteed in the can sort of thing. I think there's ones that you think probably going to make it happen. So we'll see. But I think, like, this is a good problem for Star Trek fans to have, especially after that decade-long drought.
Exactly. I mean, Star Trek has never been more prolific than this.
Yeah. But, you know, it's the streaming service era that lends itself to it, which I think is just fantastic. I think we are so unbelievably lucky right now.
Right.
So,
I mean, it's so tough to say in the world we live in of streaming and long-term play, you know, playability versus, you know, week to week viewing, like whether you can reach burnout, like whether this is, you know, reached max Star Trek where we have officially burned out the brand. Like, who knows? Like, I just don't know if they even care if it's like this is all being banked away for years to come.
Well, let me ask you this question, though. When Star Trek Lower Decks was first announced,
yeah,
you and I talked to each other like, are we going to be reviewing this week to week like we do with Star Trek Discovery? It's yeah. like a 25-minute long cartoon.
Yeah.
After we saw The Escape Artist, which right. was written by the creator of Lower Decks, I started to kind of rethink that.
Right.
You and I got, what, like 45 minutes out of this 15-minute long short trek?
Yeah.
I'm putting you on the spot here, but like I just wonder with the pedigree of some of these series that will be going to air, I wonder if there's just like enough for us to not even have to come up with like fun episode topics.
We'll have to talk about that in the future.
I know. But like
I know what you mean, like in the sense it seems like it's going to be Star Trek on the air all the time.
Yeah, so it also makes us think about like how our podcast is going to be changing fundamentally. When we started this podcast, I think it was just almost like the nadir of like Star Trek.
Well, and a lot of it was like, well, how are we going to build episodes around, say, Star Trek Beyond? You know, like events like that.
Yeah.
And, you know,
we did one episode.
Oh, we did two, actually. I think we had almost two back to back almost. But
with Star Trek Beyond?
Yeah, we did. We did a review and then we did one called Beyond Beyond.
So, Cam, that's what happens when you do 260 some episodes and they all just kind of blur together.
Yeah. But no, it is going to be very interesting to see going forward if, like, it could just be a bombardment of Star Trek. And then I do worry, though, in the sense, like, people are super excited for the Star Trek season two. Discovery premiere. Yeah. Like, there's just all over social media. People are loving it. People were excited with at least, you know, a couple of the short treks. Like, I saw the Saru one and the Escape Artist getting a lot of posts, and people were, you know, really loving those two in particular. There's a lot of excitement about Star Trek and whatever the new episodes are going to be. And I just hope they don't burn that out. Because you do see that with, like, you know, say like the Marvel stuff. It's like, who's really excited for the next Marvel movie? Yeah, we're going to see it, and hopefully it's great, but are you that excited? There's another one coming 3 months after.
Are you going to be tuning in for the Scarlet Witch Disney Plus spinoff?
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, how much before you're just like, shrug your shoulders and go, okay,
yeah,
I'll watch it, but it's nothing I'm that passionate to get online and start talking about and engaging with fellow Trek fans about.
Well, the other big problem that I find right now is that there's way too much like great TV.
Yeah.
You know, where I'm just like, how do I even find time to watch like every single series that I want to keep up with? And it's a very daunting task. I think out of obligation as a Star Trek fan, like I'll have to keep up with every single Star Trek series.
Sure, yeah.
But it makes me wonder, like, what else am I going to have time to follow?
In my eyes, and I could be completely wrong, but the way I feel...
Which is usual for you, but...
Probably. So, yeah. But, and I'm sure people at home are going to be annoyed that I even say this, but I feel like going forward, the two shows that are going to quote-unquote be essential are going to be Discovery and Picard.
Okay.
And the rest are like, watch them and enjoy them if you want to, but they aren't essential.
So here's what I think CBS, and I really wonder where CBS is at, but I think some of these ideas should be like kind of one-off seasons. You know, let's do Star Trek Section 31 as a 10 to 15 episode miniseries.
Sure.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
You and I are still baffled that they're going to be doing the Picard spinoff as an ongoing series.
Yeah.
Which kind of, it takes away from the specialness I think we were hoping for with, like, this is Picard's final 13 hours that we will witness.
Right. Here.
So, I don't know. But Cam, let's be honest. You said essential viewing. I still think that Star Trek Lower Decks is the series that I'm looking forward to most.
I'm looking forward to a lot, but it's not essential viewing. It's like, it's going to be probably, you know, a half hour, very broad comedic cartoon that for a lot of people, they're not going to really be interested in watching that.
Yeah. But I'm also curious just about the children's animated series. Like, I don't think that's going to qualify as essential viewing for the vast majority of Star Trek fans, but it's, I think, more like you and I are going to be intrigued by this.
I feel like the two animated projects are more like targeted shows where it's like, we want to get kids and maybe also maybe someone like the youths, for example, who would watch things like Family Guy or The Simpsons, or, you know, just kind of like that. Maybe not going to tune in for like an hour-long sci-fi drama, but might watch something that's really broad, colorful, and out there, like maybe what Lower Decks will be.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's just more like targeted. How can we make Star Trek appealing to different demographics of viewers?
How much, and this is a sincere question, how much do you think the Orville will be competing for Star Trek fans' eyes while we have about a million Star Trek spinoffs going on.
I think the Orville won over a lot of people.
It really
did. First season, so I think it's probably secure.
Yeah.
It just depends how long it lives on broadcast television.
It's an interesting question moving forward, because to me, like, on the surface, it doesn't seem as if that is a series long for broadcast television viewing, whereas I think it's really a series built for Netflix, essentially, where you drop 13 episodes at once, and you got, like, a hardcore fan base going all over it. But I think week-to-week viewing, that's a tougher sell for mainstream audiences this day and age.
Yeah.
So, Cam, one character I do want to touch upon, and then maybe, I don't know, if you have some final thoughts, maybe we can do a bit of a lightning round of just, like, little fun tidbits that we saw here. But, Saru, we kind of touched upon him with his kind of
great moments in this.
His joint custody of the starship with Pike. What are you hoping for with Saru with regards to the season moving forward?
Okay, I loved how they had these fun character moments with him, like where Burnham's walking down the hallway to, like, meet up with Spock. And then he's like, "Are you nervous?" She's like, "Nope." And then he, like, leans over and, like, sniffs her. And he's like, "Mm-hmm." And then there's a part two on the bridge where, like, his ganglia pops up and, like, the crew member's looking at it. He's like, "What?"
I think that might be my favorite Saru moment yet.
But where was this Saru writing in season one?
Well, that's the thing.
It feels like they recognized that they were maybe not giving Doug Jones as much as they should have.
It was so weird because I remember when we were watching it week to week, there were weeks where, like, where did Saru go? But I think it was a different journey when we did the whole, like, binge watching of the Blu-rays. And we're like, okay, well, Saru has a much clearer, more linear character
arc.
But
it's a very low-key arc.
It very much is.
Yeah.
But I think he definitely peaked in season one with that speech that he gave to the crew in the final Mirror Universe episode. Yeah. So I'm hoping for a lot from Saru because, as I said earlier in this episode, like, he's my favorite character right now.
Yeah.
And I think that he lends himself to just a very unique perspective on kind of characters within Star Trek.
And I think it's always a mistake to be like, well, if we want people to take this character seriously, we need to write them serious all the time.
Right,
which I think they did a lot in the first season of Discovery with him.
Especially with, but, you know, I'd also apply that to Burnham. I think they too often with Burnham.
Yes.
And I think she works very well with, like I said before, the lighter moments. The Saurian sneeze moments, notwithstanding.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, sure. Although, you know what I did like about that moment? Not so much, like, sneeze gags. That's pretty lame.
Yeah.
But more just, like, her reaction towards him is just, like, kind of amusement. And, like, there's, like a friendly bond there.
Well, yeah, I was going to say it's, like, their family. Like, she knows him. She's like, she's showing empathy, which is very important with her discussion with Sarek and the relationship that he hoped to kind of imbue towards Spock with bringing Burnham into the fold.
But, yeah, so, I mean, I am hopeful that we just see that type of writing with Saru. Like, Data is a character I think fans take intentionally seriously in terms of his journey and how he changed over the years and evolved. I think fans, you know, treat him as a very serious character, but he's a fun character.
Yeah.
And I think you can do that with Saru. Like, give him his moments of levity. You know, Picard had tons of moments of levity throughout the series of TNG. He was hilarious.
Every time he was dealing with children.
Yeah, especially. But
Rascals, man.
Getting hit by snowballs. But I mean, but fans, again, take Picard as a very serious character that they have a lot of reverence for. You don't have to be like, make them humorless and make them like, giving nothing but dramatic speeches all the time. Like, that's just not that fun, especially when you're doing 15 episodes a season with them.
Yeah.
It works in a two-hour movie, but not for a series.
I totally buy that. Cam, do we want to do a bit of a lightning round, just kind of thoughts that maybe we jotted down that we just haven't had time to naturally progress into during the course of this podcast? Okay. I love the fact that the new transporter chief, I was really bummed that we got rid of the guy with the awesome haircut from last season who Saru said, if you tell anyone that Mir Giorgio is on the ship, I will charge you with treason.
Right,
He had like the best haircut in the world, but now we've got like a guy with a proto Geordi LaForge visor on, which I was like, okay, I'm totally into that.
Yeah.
Bullet point for you, something you want to shout out.
Vulcan harp.
Oh, yeah.
I just loved having Burnham go into Spock's quarters, and it was so Spocky.
Or also,
I was
like,
oh man, this is great.
Pretty much every big sister going to the little brother's room, messing with his stuff.
Sure, right? Yeah. But I love that you had that a mock time Vulcan harp.
Oh, I love that. Yeah,
it was great.
Let's go back to the turbo lift sequence. I love the fact that we actually got to see the workings of a turbo lift. Remember that one shot, that VFX shot we saw of like the turbo lift actually going through the ship? Mm-hmm. We've never actually been able to witness that beyond, you know, I don't know, Picard climbing out of the turbo lift with those children in, was it Disaster or was it, yeah, I think it was Disaster, yeah, in Star Trek TNG.
Yeah, no, that was awesome to see as well. Like, I love any chance they can to just show off more of the world of this show. I really loved the Sarek Burnham stuff in this episode. I remember watching Sarek and Burnham in the first, you know, couple episodes of Discovery and being like, this is really stiff and awkward. Mm-hmm. And then you just see it now and you're like, this is the relationship I can really invest myself in. I love how, you know, Sarek has that moment where he's talking about how he could hear Amanda reading Alice in Wonderland in the next room.
Oh, I know.
And it's like, it's just like great little touches like that that make these characters feel three-dimensional.
Yes.
And not like the kind of the chilly Vulcans that we saw on, not on the original series, but on some of the other series.
It's so weird, like, as I make my way through original series, mm-hmm. and I'm just like, the Vulcans that we see there, I love them so much more than the Vulcans that we see on, say, you know, Voyager,
right,
or, you know, DS9, where, you know, they're so much more fleshed out.
Right, yeah, yeah, totally. Right.
So is Stamets friends with Sulu? Is that what the implication was when he said that he has an ethnobotanist friend on the Enterprise?
Sulu wasn't in the cage. I don't know if he's on the ship at that point.
But the cage, this is 3 years after the cage.
Yeah.
And when we first meet him on the ship,
Sulu
he's
in botany.
He's in botany.
It's quite possible. I mean,
I think
the fact that they said botany does seem
I think perhaps that's a
little too coincidental.
I think that's a Sulu shout out.
Do we ever see Sulu?
I say no. I say we never do.
Okay.
You know, I think they're keeping him off the bridge. We are going to see the 1701 bridge. Sulu's not on the bridge at this time.
Yeah.
So how do you make your way from botany to being the ace pilot aboard the flagship of the Federation?
Well, that's Star Trek promotions, man. It's the way they work. Starfleet is crazy that way.
Yeah.
I really loved just the boosted kind of playful spirit of the bridge crew. Just seeing like Awashikin and Detmer, like that scene where like Burnham's like, can you do this? Can you save Pike while he's, you know, his pod's like breaking out? And they like do that like flustered look at each other. Like moments like that were just so much fun.
Yeah.
I like seeing the bridge crew have some life to them.
Well, okay. Reese finally gets a first name.
Yeah, yeah.
And I from what I understand, so the actor is a Korean-Canadian, and I believe they gave him actually like a Korean like first name, which actually, so Gen.
Okay.
So it actually makes sense now that this man is named Reese.
Right.
You know, which, and I totally believe like, you know, like so much intermixing in the future, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
So of course, you know, surnames, blah, blah, blah. But
Right.
No, I love the bridge crew stuff. Adding to the bridge crew where, look, on TNG, where it's just kind of like, we'd get like maybe the same person at Con for, you know, like 20 episodes here or there. And
Tracy Coco's in how many episodes?
And how much do we know about that character?
Right. There's no real like characteristics of that character.
Yeah.
Like there's no personality.
And the other thing, like we'd have like LeVar Burton's stand-in. Like he would appear in the background like so often, but we didn't really know anything about that character, even though he was one of the most ubiquitous background characters ever.
Yeah.
So I love the fact that they are adding flavor to the bridge crew. That's great.
Yeah, I hope they can hold on to those actors, just because it is a very small role, and I guess we'll see going forward, you know, if whether they get other opportunities and whether they leave the show.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, being an actor is a tough gig. I don't know how well, say, for example, like that type of gig pays.
But you know what? Look, if you're an actor and you're guaranteed 13 episodes a year.
Yeah.
Or I guess it has Discovery
14
been,
for this season.
Yeah, they've been bumped to 14. So if
they always say 13. They always say 13 and then they go over.
I bet any actor would be happy to take that for like a 5 to 7 year term.
Yeah.
I
hope they can. You know what? It's not like I just want to see them in those chairs for 7 years of their lives or whatever. I want to see them have more to do so they can become like characters that it gives them the incentive to want to stay.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll give a shout out to the Brightest Star shout out that we got here.
Yeah, with Saru's sister.
Saru's talking about his sister Serana and how he does not expect to ever see her again, which means he's going to be seeing her again sometime this season, right?
Hmm.
If you have a character say that and we have a short trek that introduces her, that means that we are seeing her this season.
that could be one of the themes of obviously the season, because we have the whole Burnham and Spock relationship, right?
So that means that the season finale is going to be called Sister, right?
Well, or there's a like some sort of siblings theme throughout this season where you would tie in that sort of thing.
Did you watch the NBC drama Sisters? Or no, was it ABC back in the day?
No, but I've seen the Brian De Palma movie Sisters.
Oh, okay.
It's really good.
There you go. I've never seen it.
Margot Kidder movie. It's great. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
But no, I never watched the TV show. Is that relevant to anything?
No.
No, okay. I saw the movie with Tina Fey as well, Sisters.
Oh, yeah. That was a great comedy. I love that one.
Good, yeah.
Yeah. It was funny. Yeah. Okay.
But, yeah.
You know, so many, like, party scenes in, like, movies nowadays are just kind of boring. It's like, whatever.
Yeah.
They made this, like, a fun party.
They
that
did,
we're witnessing, so.
And, yeah, like, I do hope we get kind of that spirit on Star Trek again. I think that's something that, like, we saw in the first season of Discovery was, like, that party scene was an absolute blast. And I think just having these moments on the bridge where the characters are playing off each other and Saru's making some jokes, it just gives you that, you know, that sort of atmosphere. And you don't need Wyclef Jean bumping through every scene, but it just gives you that fun atmosphere, that hangout factor that I think Star Trek is, like, better at than almost any franchise I can think of.
Yeah.
And, you know, why not tap into that and just... It makes people want to come back. I don't know that people come back every week to find out what's going to happen with the, you know, rescued ship they found, or, you know, the settlers on a planet who are having a problem on their, you know, with their planet core or something like that. But it's more the characters bouncing off of each other, having interesting discussions, and being fun. I think that is really what makes Star Trek special. And I think this premiere had a lot of that. It had some stuff I wasn't crazy about with, like, a lot of the effects overkill stuff. I was just like, that's just me personally. It's stuff I just don't care.
And I think for you and I both, we kind of detach from what's going on. I think you and I are more intrigued by the kind of the character dynamics versus the action sequences.
And it's not even like it's not even a complaint lobbed specifically at Discovery. And I would say the same thing for a lot of movies I see. When you do these extended action sequences that are all CG, I just don't find them interesting. They don't have a lot of weight to them. I'm watching tiny little objects ping pong around a screen full of other big objects going, whatever.
Cam, last thing I want to shout out here, though, is it was revealed the Enterprise sat out this Klingon war.
Yeah.
And Pike wasn't happy about that. It had a big
effect
on his...
We had a discussion, I think, about that, too, on the podcast, where we were like, maybe they sat the flagship out because they didn't want it damaged or something.
And I think I was like, Cam, that's a silly idea.
And it turns out I was actually kind of right.
That's how it always goes down. Yeah, yeah. It's just Tyler's like, no, what are you talking about, Cam?
But I do like that... Again, there's emotional consequences. It's not just like he's back and he's like, what? Oh, the war's over? Okay, well, here I'm here to take over the ship.
Yeah.
Like, they're actually giving that character emotional baggage tied to what happened on the previous season. Like, that's the sort of thing that DS9 did incredibly well and that Discovery needs to focus more on, as opposed to overarching 14-episode arcs, you know, that can drag down a season if they don't work.
Yeah.
It's like, just give the characters emotional journeys to take over, you know, a number of episodes. That, to me, is what's really interesting. Especially when you've got charismatic actors like this group.
I'm not on the show.
Oh, boy. Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed Lissa's podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Make sure to check it out because we're going to have a video up this week talking about Star Trek the premiere, and we're going to tackle some things we didn't do in the podcast. So make sure to check that out. Again, facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, I think I know where we're going next week.
Yeah, guess, Cam.
I imagine we're doing the second episode of
Star Trek Voyager. Yeah.
Yeah. Was that Parallax?
Or Elogium? No, that was season one.
No, I think it's Parallax, maybe.
Okay, so guys.
Oh, season two, actually. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. But whatever Deadlock. The case, yes.
So Star Trek Voyager fans will be talking all about Deadlock.
Yeah, we don't know the title of Star Trek Discovery episode two.
We'll be doing episode two, but we'll have a special guest with us, Taylor Ramon. She's been on the show many times before. She's a great guest. We're very, very excited to have her back on the show once again to give us her thoughts on Star Trek Discovery.
Awesome. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vulcan Harp Smith.
And you can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTON. N as in Nartaro. I want her to be my new chief engineer.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Hello, world. I'm your wild girl.
Transfer complete.